Gatha on opening the sutra.
Case 8 from Mumun Khan, Kechu, the wheel maker. Gyatan Osho said, Kechu, the first wheel maker, made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Now, suppose you took a cart and removed both the wheels and the axles. What would you have? That's the translation from by Katsuki Sakita, Two Zen Classics. Some alternative concluding lines to that, instead of what would you have, are what would be made clear about the cart by Gon Yamada, and what will it be, says Zenkei Shimbayama. Mumun's comment is, if anyone can directly master this topic, his eye will be like a shooting star, his spirit like a flash of lightning. Mumun's verse, when the spiritual wheels turn, even the master fails to follow them. They travel in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, and west. So the immediate benefit we gain from this koan is that we now know the name of the guy who first invented the wheel. Kechu. I'm sure that makes us the first persons on our blocks. And thanks to Kechu, and thanks to the guy who first coined the word cart. So now whenever we look at a certain kind of wheeled vehicle, we're able to identify it as a cart. We have a practical need to discriminate between carts and other stuff. We have a practical need to discriminate in general, and language is our skillful or not so skillful means of doing that. But in this clarifying act of naming, which is an essential human activity, lies a hidden cost. We might say that cost, at least at times, is beginner's mind. Many koans, in one way or another, aim at undoing this loss. In this case, the issue of what is in a name is front and center. It's not so much Shakespeare's a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. A rose with no name would smell as sweet or sweeter. So words are our common currency of human interchange. They're everywhere, and they flow from us in a stream, and we're usually unconscious of that stream, and or at least unaware of words as words. But the degree to which we are unconscious is the degree to which it holds us in its sway. So once we know the name cart, we're pretty much spellbound to see it as cart. In fact, once anything is named, it becomes something, an object, out there, solid, discrete, itself. A cart is itself, not a toaster oven or a stagecoach, a wagon or a wheelbarrow, and it's certainly not a horse. Discriminations like that rescue us from being drowned in the chaotic ocean of sensory experience. You need a cart. You need a cart. You don't need a wheelbarrow. Yet that rescue, Lao Tzu says, once there are heroes, there's already disharmony in the state. Once there are rescuers, there's already disharmony in the state. And you could even say, once there are words, there's already disharmony. There's separation, there's dualism. The way I came at this koan it meant a lot to me, this koan. It awakened to me to the longing for, once there are words, to overcome the separation of words brain. And words are such an everyday miracle that they induce us to forget that longing. They're really good substitutes. So we're sitting here today at some level because we feel that longing for separation to end. And our original nature is always with us. We're always in some dimension afloat in an undifferentiated ocean of being. And that dimension of our being is always calling out to us. Our twin to our everyday mind. And there's only moments when that din slows down that we hear the call from that undifferentiated ocean. For me, there's a haiku by Basho that says this perfectly. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. Mm-hmm. So he's in the midst of the bustle of the everyday. The carts are creaking through the streets. The merchants are calling out. But Basho hears the call of the cuckoo. And that call from the wild world awakens in him that desire for Kyoto, the absolute Kyoto. Kyoto is the city of 1,000 temples. So there are 1,000 places in Kyoto, really an unlimited number of places in Kyoto, where that there are actually places erected in the name of that long, that are erected in the name of that intersection of the everyday and the absolute, or the unconditioned way of things. So today's koan, even though it's made of words, Keichu the wheelmaker, is itself a kind of cuckoo cry that invites us to inhabit the world before the use of the word, the first use of the word cart, and before the first use of the word wheel, and before the first humans, and before the first bang. The big bang, the first bang, which precedes the first human. And that's the world that we live in. And it's just concealed in this anesthetizing glory of language and in practical stuff and verbal negotiations. Language is, because it's so good, we tend to forget that the finger that points at the moon is not the moon. And we forget that the moon is not the moon. So let's go back to imagine the time before language. There's a great account of this by a German philosopher named Ernst Cassirer. It's called Language and Myth, in his book Language and Myth. It's a small book. And he calls those first words momentary deities, which is something I've always loved. At the outset, he thinks that language and myth are exactly the same. That there's a sensory blur, a big cascade, and a sound is uttered, and then things are plucked out of the flux. Sun, moon, first flower, flowers, spring. And at the outset, they're all deities. And in fact, everything in that sort of mythic or sacralized universe is a deity. You give it a sound, and then you create this kind of order. Here's how he explains it. Uttered sounds of language confront man not as a creation of his own, but as an objective reality. As soon as the tension and the emotion of the moment has found its discharge in the word or the mythical image, a sort of turning point has occurred in human mentality. The inner excitement, which was a mere subjective state, has vanished and resolved itself into the objective form of myth or speech. So Kassir defines man as a symbol-making animal, and thus for him, as a philosopher, he has a big stake in the abstract. The birth of language, the ultimate symbol system, is a turning point. And he says that once the word, the momentary deity, comes into being, the inner excitement, which was, he says, a mere subjective state, has vanished and resolved itself into the objective. Mere subjectivity? The excitement of subjectivity vanishes in the face of the great God of objectivity. But isn't Zazen all about the resourceful restoration of that non-dual subjectivity, of the intimacy with the nameless, the moment by moment being? So, in the world beyond objects, before words, and prior to them, prior to the momentary, and then, unfortunately, the permanent deities, what we have is this non-separation. In samadhi, the world is a not-two, which is where the koan would like to jujitsu us. Gaitan Osho said, Kechu, the first wheel maker, made a cart whose wheels had 100 spokes. Now suppose we took a cart and removed both the wheels and the axles. What would you have? In the commentary by Katsuki Sakita, he says that the wheels are like the body and the axle is like the brain. So the koan is asking us what we are apart from our body and apart from our mind. He may be forcing that interpretation on it, but at any rate. So Mumon's comment is that if anyone can directly master this topic, his eye will be like a shooting star, his spirit like a flash of lightning. In other words, if we let go of our labels and of our objectifications and of our cartography, we can be illuminated, and we can be illuminating. We will be delivered flash from mere objectivity into the great joy of being. And there's another great koan, which I just ran across last week, by the great modernizer or the person who revivified the tradition of haiku in Japan, Masaoka Shiki. It's this: lightning flash in the bottom of the basin, water somebody forgot to throw out. So, yeah. Were it not for the everyday and the neglected thing, there wouldn't be any flash. And what could be more ordinary than wash water, or for that matter, a cart? And if we can let go of it, there's the flash. So when the flash arrives, then why does Mumon say, and this is what drives us nuts about koans, and it tempts us to think of them as enhanced interrogation techniques. When the spiritual wheels turn, even the master fails to follow them. They travel in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, and west. So why is it that the master fails to follow them? And that's to make us fail to figure out the koan in the terms that it's presented in its own language. It's not a failure. If we let go of the cart, there is nothing to follow. We are the cart. We are the wheels. And If you want proof of that, I want you to think of your memory of that eminent Buddhist, Tina Turner. She is actually a long-time practicing Buddhist, as she's gyrating and belting out the big wheels keep on turning. So how could you separate the dancer from the dance? How can you take the song out of Tina Turner, or how can you take the Tina Turner out of the song or the dance away from them all? Yes. In our culture, there's a huge bias in favor of objectification, of the fancy word for it in academia is logocentrism, the word at the center. And we see this at the beginning in the Bible. In the beginning in the Word, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. A Zen reading of that might be to say that the world, quote unquote, the world came into being when we, also known as God, began to conceive of it as a world and with a beginning. And then, of course, once you have a beginning, then you have to figure out.
You have a very special, particular relation to words because it's, you're a poet and you're a teacher. So you must constantly be dealing with...
Yeah, it's pretty much like, you know, the people who are most effective treating heroin addicts are former heroin addicts. Mm-hmm. Or current heroin addicts, in my case.
But people with a distrust for words, and therefore sometimes distrusted poetry, thinking they were poems were manipulative and really deceitful in some way. How do you discriminate between them? Is it a matter of whether they take you someplace else beyond the words or not? Is that? I mean, there's a huge reservoir of poetry in our culture, and in many cultures. And
I think you answered that. They take us beyond words.
I think that that's why people distrust poetry, because you can't trust the words in a poem to mean exactly what they mean. You know, poetry is not objective. And so I think that people who are most hung up on words are the people that probably tend to mistrust poetry.
Mm-hmm. Poetry is not technical writing. That's the thing. I mean, if you have that kind of engineering mind, you're probably not going to be very entranced by poetry, which can be... You ask three people about a poem and you're going to get three different interpretations. That was the thing that drove me crazy sometimes, because I wanted to give the right answer. What does this poem mean? Mm-hmm. The teacher would ask. Well, is my answer right or not? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe there isn't any right answer. Maybe the poem means different things to different people, and even different things to the same person at different times.
That's the problem with koans. What's the right answer?
I have no doubt that maybe we might have gotten three slightly different interpretations of that koan, three others, if we had three more different Dharma talks.
I hope so. Used to be, you know, when I was even in college, the idea that the teacher had the right answer to the poem. That was, it's still entrenched. It's only the growth of skeptical awareness of language and things like the Vietnam War, which have undone the spell of authority enough to say, screw you, dude, my interpretation is just as good as yours, which is also a morass too, because then anything, you can say anything is true about the common. It's just pure relativism.
You can try to say that.
That's right. As long as they're grades.
Doesn't you on it.
You don't mind the stick.
I think the poetry, like anything, is really like anything else, is there's no one objectivity. You see the rug differently than I do. Mm-hmm. At the same moment, I would think. Is there anything that has a totally objective reality?
When I first came here, Steph accused me of being too abstract and said that I'm going to teach you that this stick is a stick. Do you remember that?
Still is.
And my brain just never stops. I mean, it's just words, 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 even when I'm, you know, empty-headed. that meant a lot to me. And when you were quoting the philosopher that you quoted about mere subjectivity and the deity of words releasing one from mere subjectivity into, it almost sounded to me like you were saying the freedom of objectivity. When I heard that, I remembered that remark that Steph made to me about the stick. And there is a stickness to a stick that I don't really get, but I believe there is. Sometimes I get it. And so I know there are times when if one of you would hold up a stick to me and say, what is this? There would be an absolute answer, maybe. Or maybe the absolute answer would be stick. So it can go a lot of different ways. Right?
Interesting. Just as you said that, there's a huge difference between saying stick and between saying a stick.
And there's a huge difference between a stick and a branch. There's a branch and a power line. If it was a stick, we wouldn't be worrying about it. When you talk about the stickness, I think that that's a tricky thing, because the essence business is actually a language construction. So it's possible, you know, when does a stick begin and end? Is there one thing that you can, is there an essence to a stick? And it might be that there isn't. It might be that there are family resemblances. There are things that you see that aren't always in every single stick.
This stick that he showed me was a stick.
Yeah, right. Right, but it's because we call it a stick, though. Right? If we, in the world of Lilliputs, that might be a redwood. You know, the tiny people.
So what does that mean then?
So we get stuck in the stick. Once we got the stick, then we say, well, that's a stick. And you know, then we're stuck with that to some extent. Unless we could say, okay, a really ugly person. This is not a great example. But, and you think, oh, ugly person. And then when do you let go of ugly person and just be with that person?
Yeah. When you become a mirror.
Yeah, nice.
A mirror never discriminates.
Yeah.
You can put an ugly person and it'll reflect it perfectly. A beautiful person, it'll reflect it perfectly. So we need to become mirrors.
Mm-hmm. Words, I think, are one of those, it's our mind's attempt to put a bridle on the horse. Yeah. We want to grab the horse, we want to put the bridle on it, we want to put the saddle on it, we want to put, you know, and we want to be able to control it, because once we have control over it, we can then go on to something else and control that.
I think Emerson said, words are in the saddle and ride mankind.
who said that?
Emerson.
Wow.
But yet we couldn't do without them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my question. Is it possible to use words as an expedient means of communication, but not as a bridle on the horse?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. You mean by expedient, skillful means of it? Because expediency is just the brute practicality.
Well, it is expedient. If I scream fire, for example, and because we need to get out of the building, but
that's a great example right there.
You know, that's expedient. It may also be skillful, so what I'm asking is there a way that we can live with words that it's not a prison, mm-hmm. that it's not a damper on our perception?
That's a great question.
I sure as hell hope so.
Maybe we're trying right now to do that.
That's what Steph said.
Yeah. So we have to... Yeah. That's what koans do. And so if you don't like koans, which many of us feel that way regularly, what's really behind that? Is it... Do you not want to lose the control of objectivity? Because if you're forsaking language, it's our main means of creating perspective.
I think the problem is less on putting words onto things and more on putting things onto words, I guess. You know, I think that all of us in this room would agree that Rosie is a dog, but if we took Rosie out of the room and said dog, we'd probably have 12 different dogs in our heads, mm-hmm. but we might still think that we agree on what a dog is, and we don't, we don't all agree. I might see a snarling, pit bull chasing me down the street, and somebody else might see a lap dog that they're, And so, it's different reactions to the same word, but they're not all the same thing.
That also brings up the point that we can use our words as we think expediently, but we have no control over how other people hear them and what other people do with them. Mm. They could solidify them and make them somehow sacred.
There's another way of looking at words as kinds of bodhisattvas. They're just there, and they take our coloration. It's like they're our mirrors. They're there waiting for us, and they're selfless servants. They have no say. That's how Merlin looks at words, who is a person who has more quarrels with naming things than any poet, but goes along with this deep, deep affection for using them as expediently in Peter's sense.
I work with people who have no words, mm-hmm. who have no language, and it strips away a lot of stuff. But I still know when they're happy. I still know when they're disappointed. I still know when there's something wrong. And it takes a lot more to figure out what that is. What makes me happy? What's wrong at that particular time?
That strikes me as very interesting, Mary. Would you be right to say that the words are merely the expression of our attachment, not the root of our attachment.
Mm-hmm. Yes and no.
Sometimes it's good just to let the horse run free.
So in ways that's a more intimate relationship you're talking about, because you have to feel them rather than
you have to learn their wordless language.
So they have a language. It's just different from
verbal. They do, but it's not verbal. These people are not verbal.
I've also read, though, and I have such a list, I got it off the internet, of names for feelings. He said quizzically or depressed or whatever. And if you give the list to a person who has tremendous difficulty understanding their own feeling states or is anesthetized to them, just showing them the list of how you might feel there actually represents a liberation for them. It allows them, because they're out there as stimuli that's stuck in their brains as memories, to are you angry? Well, yeah, but are you also sad? Yeah. And then you can start opening up. The fact is that we're many different feelings at once.
And it's also true that maybe the right word isn't on that list.
Yeah.
But that person is mostly feeling.
Yeah.
But then it comes back to, in my former business as a reporter, even in school, we were always discouraged from the temptation, which sometimes happened in occasionally in English class, where you were, you took a quote from somebody, then you appended the adverb. Mm-hmm. He said angrily. Mm-hmm. He said happily. Mm-hmm. The first thing they did in class was to strip that away from us because they pointed out quite correctly, that's only your interpretation. How did you know what emotion the person was feeling or what they were trying to convey with their words? The words have to speak for themselves, because there may be a disconnect between that person and yourself. And in which case it's sort of you get very, very subjective sometimes. So, I think we were trying to say the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's never just one thing anyway.
No.
That's the, somebody once said, poetry is the clear expression of mixed emotions.
I like that.
I have to say, I love your description of koans as enhanced interrogation.
Although it is, you have to sort of cross yourself for the people who actually have endured the real thing.
We have been thinking about replacing the candle with a single light over
there. Yeah. And a bucket of water.
Well, there's the whole meditating under the waterfall tradition. You can just meditate under the lake.
Apparently not.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them.
Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable.